We're finishing off your conversation.
I guess I just have a few piecemeal things to say. The first is I'm not discounting the role of kinship and other variables in, you know, the social cohesion and social pressures that get people to do terrifically unwise things. And the problem for me is not, I'm not worried about the bad people in the world. I'm not worried about the sociopaths who have frontal lobe anomalies and can't feel empathy for others and therefore, you know, kill and eat people. There be people like Jeffrey Dahmer in the world, and you know, belief is not necessarily what is so operative. What scares me the most about certain kinds of divisive dogmatisms, and I think religion being the preeminent flavor of that, and at this moment in its history, Islam being the most exquisitely pungent of those flavors, is that it enables perfectly sane, perfectly rational people, people who are not suffering obvious psychopathology, people who are not suffering the kinds of oppressions that would lead anyone else to misbehave terribly, to fly planes into buildings, and to seek to get nuclear weapons so that they can blow themselves up in certain circumstances. And what I hear Scott doing is discounting the role of specific beliefs. I think it really matters specifically what people believe, and that there are innumerable instances where we can see that the proximate cause of certain behavior is precisely what a person believed, in this case about God and paradise and the evils of infidels. And so one thing I would say to you, Scott, is that you have some, if Islam is really orthogonal to this problem, or variable number 10 on your list of variables, a few things you should explain. One is, where are the Palestinian Christian suicide bombers? You know, most of the Palestinians are Muslims, obviously, but there are Palestinian Christians who have to go through the same checkpoints. They suffer the same humiliations by Israelis. I mean, it seems to me this is practically a science experiment. We have the same people speaking the same language, living in the same deplorable conditions. One group rather reliably forms a death cult, and the other doesn't. And another example I'd like to put on the table. Where are the Tibetan Buddhist suicide bombers? If oppression were enough to so derange a culture that they would blow themselves up on school buses, and where you could get crowds by the tens of thousands calling for the deaths of non-combatants, we would see Tibetan Buddhists blowing themselves up on Chinese school buses. And what we don't see that. What we do see among Tibetan Buddhists, and there are many examples of this, we see Tibetan Buddhist monks and nuns who have been tortured in Chinese prisons for decades, but really tortured, you know, with cattle prods and, you know, electric shock to the genitals, coming out of these decades of torture, saying things like, my greatest fear while I was in prison was that I would lose my sense of compassion for my torturers. Now I submit to you, given that behavior, we might think it's pathological on some level to have that kind of compassion, but that behavior is fully explicable in terms of the ideology of Tibetan Buddhism, its emphasis on compassion, its view of torturing as an expression of a person's ignorance within a context of rebirth. I mean, it is anchored by a certain kind of worldview. And I would say to you that given what Muslims believe, you will never find a Muslim coming out of decades of torture in an Israeli prison who will speak in those terms at all. So that's, you know, you can react to those two examples. And
yeah, good empirical claims. False. Okay. Could I just have one slide?
Oh, this is the handout that's outside, the mysterious handout. I don't know if...
This is a study by a colleague of mine who works with me on...
Could you... you have
this, is a study, by a colleague of mine who works with me on the evolution of religion. He is a logistic regression looking at the odds of scapegoating, which is highly correlated with dogmatism and flexibility of belief and commitment to violence among 10,000 people in, over 10,000 people in 10 countries around the world. And so you have Catholics, Protestants, Orthodox, other Christians, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, non-religious, atheists, and agnostics, and others. Okay, this is the odds of scapegoating for people who believe there is only one God and it's my God versus people who believe in God as a supernatural entity, okay? Or people who believe that there is no difference. What we've got is in terms of, no, I'm not going to show the rest of them. What we got is exclusivity, that is a tendency to scapegoating, is highest for Catholics, Orthodox, and atheists. Okay? It is lowest for Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims. Okay, that's the only empirical evidence I know about sort of intrinsic notions, which is a large sample size of scapegoating. And it's, as I said, it's virtually identical for violence and inflexibility of belief. Now, with respect to Palestinians, Buddhists, right? Mm. Well, you know, Buddhists, there were Japanese Buddhists who were kamikaze, yeah, of course, and the Sri Lankan army actually is threatening to do suicide squads against the Tamil Tigers, who are Hindu suicide squads. As far as the Palestinians are concerned, you get about 70% support, depending on the threat perception at the moment. The survey's done. The surveys are done mostly by Khalil Shikaki of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah. You get about 70% in a random sample among Christians for support for suicide terrorism, depending on threat perception. Now, the reason there aren't almost none, although Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades does allow Christians, the reason that...
Have there been Christian suicide bombers?
No.
Okay.
The reason that there isn't is because the particular groups that are formed are, actually there have been, PFLP, suicide bombers, Palestinian Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. There have been six cases, I believe. There's a mostly Christian Marxist organization. The reason they have suicide bombers is very simple, and the reason Al-Qaeda has it is very simple. Suicide bombing, especially by Hamas operatives and Al-Qaeda operatives, are by their best and brightest. That is, the majority of suicide bombers are college-educated, fairly well-off relative to the surrounding populations, no desperation, poverty, no criminal backgrounds, no insanity, no suicidal tendencies. And the organizations make a very costly commitment, a sort of Zahavi handicapping principle, to use their best and their brightest to get the community to trust them and increase their political market share. And they've been so unbelievably successful that the PFLP, which is a secular Marxist organization, and the DFLP, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, if you go to their websites, they're indistinguishable now from the Hamas. That is, you've got incantations, almost Quranic. They're not Quranic, but they use the same words for sacrifice. And Al-Qaeda, the success of suicide bombing by Al-Qaeda is a very contingent affair, very similar to the Nazis, okay? There's a marvelous book called 30 Days. It's about Hitler's rise to power in January 1933. On January 1st, the major newspapers in Germany declared Hitler's party dead. He had lost two successive elections. By the end of the month, he's Chancellor of Germany. Through unbelievably improbable events, set of events that no one would have predicted. And that takes over the fascist movement, basically. It becomes the paragon of fascism around the world. Bin Laden, same thing. He was one of about 40 Mujahideen commanders. And he got this bright idea basically from a combination of the Hezbollah and the Tamil Tigers, used it effectively, created unbelievable theater. And that theater was inordinately successful at, again, it was a media-driven political awakening, at mobilizing consciousness among a vast number of people. And Islam had this characteristic. It is a messianic religion, like Christianity, like all the monotheisms, and like all the isms, communism, anarchism, all the secular versions of Christianity. And it is a multi-state system. And in the sort of advance of a unipolar United States power, it was seen by many people, this theater, this successful theater, as empowering these non-state actors. And so it became widely popular, so even bin Laden's enemies joined him and called themselves Al-Qaeda. But by the way, Al-Qaeda was never in common use until the United States put the word out there in the Southern District Court of New York in 1990 for the bombing of the African embassies, when, just like in the Joe Valachi trial, the prosecutor asked Jamal al-Fadl, "Do you know of Al-Qaeda?" He says, "Well, it's a list." "And who's on this list?" "Well, it was a list we made up in Afghanistan to track the Mujahideen." "So Al-Qaeda is this organization by bin Laden. And what else does Al-Qaeda do?" And by the time the end of the transcript is finished, Al-Qaeda becomes a concept that everybody's talking about. It's publicized around the world, and it's the first concept out there at 9/11. And suddenly everybody's Al-Qaeda. But if you go to Guantanamo and you ask the people, are they Al-Qaeda, they say no.
So can I just address some of the things you brought up? Because I agree that affiliation with Al-Qaeda is a red herring. And this is an ideology that spreads, as you pointed out. It's massively enabled by the internet. And whether someone has ever spoken to Osama bin Laden or has ever received an email from Al-Qaeda, they can be operating under the same ideology. I'm not sure how much of what you said has addressed my central concern. I will fully concede that there are other ways to think yourself into suicidal terrorism. I did not know there were any Christian suicide bombers, and it doesn't surprise me, but the thing that I want to point out is that there's a real difference between how easily you can morph the ideology of martyrdom and jihad within Islam to this kind of behavior, and how much more work you have to do in Christianity as it is currently practiced, and in Buddhism. Now, you mentioned the Zen Buddhists, the kamikaze pilots of World War II. I can easily describe why Zen Buddhism, in combination with Shinto and Japanese military chauvinism, could get you an ideology that was very martial and justify that behavior, and why the Tibetan Buddhists are a very unlikely candidate population for that behavior, given what they believe about compassion. You know, among Buddhists, one of the real problems with Zen is that it does not emphasize compassion at all, or very much, and you can get this very kind of militant samurai sort of, the sword of wisdom kind of ethos, and without much practical application of compassion. So I'm still arguing for the logical consequences of ideas, and I just think that there's an obscurantism at the heart of the way you're talking about this that troubles me, because this is what I think. If the Quran was exactly the way it is, but it contained a single extra line, and that line read, if you see a red-haired woman on your doorstep at sunset, cut her head off. Okay, just imagine a text like this. It comes down through the ages that contains a line like that. I can tell you what kind of world we would live in. We would live in a world where red-haired women would be found murdered in the Muslim world. We would, we'd open the New York Times and we would hear that there were, 20 heads found in a bag, and they were all red-haired women. We would also live in a world in which apologists for Islam would look at that behavior and say, that has nothing to do with Islam. There was a news story yesterday about a Mormon man who killed his wife and she had red hair. Many of those women who were found in the, you know, whose heads were found in the bag in Baghdad were not actually redheads, but some were strawberry blonde. We would hear about women who were shot and not decapitated, and decapitation is the only thing that is sanctioned in the Quran. I mean, this is the kind of gymnastics we would be faced with. And the basic fact about the Quran, as it is with so many other books like Leviticus and Deuteronomy, and there's nothing worse than Leviticus and Deuteronomy as far as I can tell, but people ignore them, as Richard pointed out. The basic problem with the Quran is that it really does preach hatred and fear of the infidel far more eloquently than it preaches anything else. And that is a problem we are living with, and no amount of casuistry is going to get us around that until we find some way of empowering the forces of moderation in the Muslim world. And I would agree with you, in a hostage negotiation, you don't tell them that your religion is bullshit. I think we are engaged in a very different hostage negotiation now, talking about the role of science and intellectual honesty.
Let me just say about the kamikaze, there's a book called When Cherry Blossoms Fall. They were not militant. There was not much of a militant ideology. They were basically German romantics.
Read Zen at War and Zen War Stories.
This is their diaries.
Let me comment on the kamikazes for a moment, just because it's in the moment. And I know my esteemed colleague here, aren't we forgetting a couple of things here? That, for example, the American admirals in the Pacific, once they saw that Japanese pilots were, instead of firing missiles and bombs to the ships, started flying their planes into the ships, they knew that there was a turn in the war at that point, because as effective as that was, as an act of war, they knew that Japan's capacity to wage war was on a dramatic decline. Because had that been, it was not the first choice for Japan to engage kamikaze bombers. And so if we go to Islam, there's a question I haven't heard asked yet. Because we're looking at suicide bombings as some kind of intrinsically noble exercise within the paradigm and abhorrent from the outside. But would there be suicide bombings if the Islamic community had their own air force and tanks? I don't think so. They would be invoking the military machines that the rest of the West has available to itself.
And they say so quite specifically.
Okay.
I wouldn't be quite that sanguine. There wouldn't be suicide bombings, perhaps. But this notion of martyrdom, either you believe in martyrdom as a genuine metaphysical principle, or you don't. If you do, it has certain behavioral and logical consequences. We have, get the U.S. out of this. Look at the war between Iran and Iraq. The Iranian mothers were sending their teenage sons out to clear minefields with their lives, thinking they were going to get to paradise and get the whole family in after them. We were not, this was not Iran against the great Satan. This was not an expression of their entanglement with Israel. This was, I mean, how do you get a mother to celebrate the suicidal atrocities of her children? She has to believe something. Now, more often than not, you know, I'm with Weinberg, who thinks she has to believe something religious. Now, you can get me some kind of Marxist ideology hammered into her head that may get her to feel consoled by that behavior. But, you know, martyrdom is good enough, and martyrdom is very well subscribed. And so whether they're willing to blow up nukes or just not be deterred in a mutually assured destructive sort of way, the way the Soviet Union was, that's really what I'm worried about. I'm worried about a world in which we wake up and we see the psychological equivalents of the 19 hijackers armed with long-range nuclear weapons. And then we have to think, well, are these really rational actors? I mean, are they as pragmatic as Scott says? Or are these guys really willing to hit the wall at 400 miles an hour? I think they're telling us they're willing to hit the wall. Many of them are hitting the wall. I think as a rhetorical device, that's pretty persuasive. So I'm inclined to take them seriously.
Yeah, but again,
Lawrence,
I want to step back a little bit for the debate that you started earlier with your question to Sam to some extent. And actually something you said, Sam, now allows me to bring it back, which is I'm kind of amused. The basic point that you make very cogently is that we have this unusual and totally non-rational acceptance of religious sensibility, especially when those sensibilities are ludicrous. Mm. And the easy example is in this case maybe Islam, as or you can pick whatever, or the Old Testament. But you're much more tolerant in your statement, of course, of Buddhism. You talked about the Buddhist who had this compassion, but the compassion was based on nonsense. It's based on reincarnation.
Well, I can unpack that, but...
Yeah, but, yeah. But okay, but the point is, it's clear to me that you're much more willing to, in some sense, be respectful of a nonsensical religious belief which leads to a positive result, perhaps. And yeah, I know, I want you to comment on that. I'm sure you'll not agree with that statement, but I want you to elaborate on it. But I think what that reflects is this question that you were asking earlier, which is the a priori attack on religious faith in general, or in fact, not religious faith, but faith in things which you cannot, for which you have no evidence whatsoever, as a general statement that is a bad thing, that making that attack is perhaps not empirically advised, nor is it sensible to do. And I have to say, as an empirical fact, I've evolved in my own discussions. If I talked here 5 years ago, I would have sounded much more like Steve or you or Richard, perhaps, in debating people on the issue of evolution around the country. I suddenly got hit with realizing how offensive, how illogical the statements that were being applied from what I was saying was being received by the people I was talking to. In particular, I remember debating, I forget the guy's name, who's head of the Intelligent Design Network in Kansas. That old fella, he's a nice old guy. Do you remember his name? Anyway, and he trotted out this letter from 50 Nobel laureates trying to defend evolution. They said, there's no evidence for design and purpose in the universe. And then the next sentence says, there is no design and purpose in the universe. And he said, see, these people are trying to preach atheism. And I thought, that's the worst thing they can be doing, because in fact that has nothing to do with evolution, because evolution has nothing to do with the design and purpose of the universe. It has to do with the development of diversity of species on Earth through natural selection. And so that by going out and immediately attacking the notion that believing things without any evidence is empirically bad, or is just not acceptable, that we are stepping beyond our role as scientists, and inevitably it becomes emotional. You don't mind, you wouldn't preach as much against Buddhism as you would against Islam, because you don't like Islam less than you like Buddhism. And
no,
so
you're right. Well,
so anyway, those are the things I wanted to provoke both of you, but I think sort of it's a way to bridge between the two of you.
No, good question. It's not that I'm pulling any punches from Buddhism based on some kind of dogmatic affinity with Buddhists or having been raised Buddhist. I mean, this is not what's going on. I happen to think that within Buddhism there's an extraordinarily nuanced and interesting methodology for meditation, and some very sophisticated discussion of the nature of consciousness, the possibilities of transforming our moment-to-moment perception of the world that link up rather nicely with what we understand about neuroplasticity and the human brain at this moment. If you sit in a room with the Dalai Lama talking to physicists and neuroscientists, you'll see that there is for the most part, a very open and unconstrained dialogue going on.
But the basic premise is nonsense, right?
Reincarnation. Well, reincarnation, who knows? Who knows in the sense that there's no... I mean, there are these spooky stories where, you know, kid... I am not... Okay. Okay. Well, reincarnation, you are on firm ground being skeptical of reincarnation. Let me say that, okay? This is going to take us far afield. I have published a few spooky things about telepathy and reincarnation, which amount to not an endorsement of these beliefs, but just, you know, I hear there's all this data. Someone like Dean Radin writes a book about it. Brian Josephson, a Nobel laureate in physics, blurbs it. Okay. I don't have the time to do the meta-analyses or the statistical expertise, So listen, I'm awaiting the evidence, okay? So I don't want to talk about reincarnation. It may be...
Life after death experience.
All right.
No, let me answer the root of your question, which is, it really matters what the consequences of these dogmas are. I mean, it's not that all dogma is equally pernicious. And the problem with dogma is that there's no, I mean, you can't necessarily predict just how many lives it's going to cost. And so you take one like this idea that the soul enters the zygote at the moment of conception. You know, life starts at the moment of conception. This sounds totally benign. In fact, life-affirming. Why not believe this, right? Then we invent something called stem cell research, and we have a president who vetoes federal funding of it because he and millions of other Christians think that every three-day-old human embryo has a soul which has interests which cannot be trumped by the interests of a little girl with full-body burns or spinal cord injury or diabetes. And we seem to be at a stalemate in our ethical debate in this culture. And unless we are willing to criticize the dogma at that point, we really are left in a situation where tens of millions of people have conditions that could be remediated potentially by stem cell research, or for which stem cell research is the best game in town as far as generating therapies, and we are not pursuing it aggressively. So this is where dogma begins to be really troubling. And if certainty about reincarnation were doing work that I could see anywhere that was analogous to the work of martyrdom, I would be telling the Buddhists, until you had evidence, this is pernicious nonsense. This is getting a lot of people killed. Now, there are situations in which it may get people killed. I can fully predict what those situations might be, or at least venture a guess. But the problem, that's not the problem I'm seeing with Buddhists now. The problem I'm seeing with Buddhists is they are entangled with a lot of New Age mumbo jumbo that makes their discourse basically seem unscientific.
Well, it seems to me ultimately, last thing.
Yeah, but she's not going to go anywhere.
Oh. Roger, I have to go to the airport. Can I just make one statement?
Yes.
Okay. Just want to leave you with one thought. I agree there's lots of nonsense in the world, and that science may or may not, though I see no historical evidence that there's any interesting thing science has done for morals yet, or ethics or politics or anything else. In fact, I've seen the contrary. But let's suppose there is. And let's suppose that it's a good mission to get rid of the nonsense in the world. This is your problem, which you're not facing. How to advance science and reason in a fundamentally irrational world? Not to wish it to go away, not to believe that by rational argument it will go away, but how to deal with that problem. It is a very, very hard problem.
I gotta go.
Thank you, Scott.
Well,
I'm going to respond to you as you walk out as well.
Yeah. Well.
Can I just say one thing, Roger? Because in response to those applause.
Well, apparently, according to the people up there, your microphone's trumping mine at the moment.
Okay. So all right. I'm going to use my advantage. Rational argument actually does occasionally, and I think rather often, change people's minds about God. I mean, I am the recipient of thousands upon thousands of emails now, from people who used to be fundamentalists. Who got argued out of it. I mean, the trying to square their ludicrous beliefs about the world with the consequences of those beliefs and with the testimony of rationality on 100 fronts has eroded their confidence in those beliefs. And, you know, you wouldn't know this. I mean, we have this kind of shibboleth which says you can't what wasn't reasoned into existence can't be reasoned out. The truth, I think, is rather much closer to this, that people are making desperate efforts, rather heroic efforts, every day of their lives to be reasonable, to have a coherent worldview. And when those efforts become too costly or too embarrassing, dogma loses. And I can just tell you that there are ministers in this country preaching to flocks, ministers who have completely lost their belief, but can't figure out what other job to do. And so we're just literally getting up on Sundays, espousing what they now know to be nonsense. There's every permutation of that. There are fundamentalists who become moderates who become atheists. And so it's just not true that people can't be argued out of their beliefs.
Well, I'd like to make a comment. I'm Alan Gilchrist, vision scientist at Rutgers. I think a lot of you know there was this scientific study done by a team at Hopkins University recently using scientific polling techniques to find out, to estimate how many innocent civilians had been killed in the Iraq War. And these are scientific techniques they're using despite what the president says. And the estimate they came up with was about 600,000. I was disturbed, especially yesterday and somewhat today. I mean, I love people like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris. They're heroes of mine. But I was a little disturbed by the ease with which people in this group here fell into that same language about Islam and how much worse it is than Christianity. And I think we should all be reminded, we can have our speculation about what Islam, I've heard people not here, but other people talking about how Islam wants to take over the world, they're an evil religion. Well, that may or may not be true, but what's happening on the ground in the Middle East is basically one of Christians killing Muslims. And I think it's very convenient to talk about, you know, what a violent religion Islam is. But what's happening on the ground in the Middle East? That's my point.
Okay, so there's a couple of things here. One thing is that we've got, don't forget, there's all tomorrow morning. So, Sam, if there's other things you want to do, we can do that then. We really need to move, and of course, the other thing about Buddhism, as I understand it, having actually been in gatherings with the Dalai Lama, is that he always says, if there's anything wrong, we change it. No problem. So if there's an issue, he changes the science, as I understand. If the science contradicts the religion, my understanding is that he's all in favor of changing it. So Harry Croteau has been waiting patiently to come up and talk to us. Harry will now solve all the world's problems with a description of... you need this thing. Let me just introduce you. Okay. So Harold Croteau is currently at Florida State University. He was Sussex before that. He's a former president of the Royal Society of Chemistry and a Nobel laureate from 1990s.
I can't remember either. Don't worry.
For discovering with Rick Smalley the C60, the structure of carbon-60, which he was instrumental in naming Buckminster fullerene.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you, Roger, for inviting me to... Normally, I'm in the company of Nobel Prize winners, but now I realize I'm in the company of some people who are a lot smarter in many ways, and I'm sort of certainly worried about this. And but anyway, I think I'd like to start with a Nobel laureate, John Cornforth, who's a great friend of mine, and particularly with regard to the teapot. I actually do believe in the teapot after John pointed out that what about an astronaut who just decided to throw out a teapot out of his spaceship, and therefore there could be a teapot circling at least the Earth. And the point is that, you know, we still don't know. But my talk is actually the Enlightenment is under threat. Can it be saved by the Internet? And I'm going to discuss my small part in my attempts. I think something that is interesting about the printing press is that the printing press enabled people all over the world to start to write about themselves and the things that they made an impact. I don't think there was any general education before the printing press, and I think the internet has a new dimension of audiovisual materials. But the scale of the problem, it seems to me, is vast. I mean, we have an audience here of not too many, but these are the audiences of evangelicals and in obviously in Mecca and other places of all people. This is in Nigeria, where they converted apparently in 1 week about 1 million people to evangelical Christianity. And those people probably paid as well. And so I did actually find two people in the crowd here. Richard and Sam Harris were actually those little two black spots in there. But they were somewhat outnumbered, it seemed to me. The assets of the are phenomenal, and as you all know, those are just the capital. The $88 billion that went into in the US, into religious institutions is just enormous. The $400 million budget for the Campus Crusade for Christ. And I talked to a couple of these guys on the FSU campus, and as soon as I started to ask them questions which troubled them. They had a defense mechanism that one dragged the other guy away. It was very interesting to see that they've got this defense mechanism that they only want to project what they have to say, but there was no discussion with me that was possible. Indoctrination, which I think Richard has talked about, is just phenomenal. It's increasing in the UK. This is a Christian play school, madrasa in the old days. In fact, there's a Sikh in the middle here of Muslim children. There's a modern madrasa. Cheder in probably in Poland and Jewish children today. It seems to me that these are sort of issues. I think we only need to look at Northern Ireland. This is Newsweek magazine. That's interesting. We've got Newsweek magazine many years ago. Gerald, 12, if I were Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, this is how I would solve our problems. First, I would split Northern Ireland into two parts, and I would put the Protestants on one side and the Catholics on the other. David, 14, I would pass a law saying that any Roman Catholic who set foot on the street to start trouble would be shot instantly and without mercy. I would starve them like rats until there wasn't one left in Northern Ireland. I believe that the separate school system in Northern Ireland was responsible for propagating the attitudes that were there in the family. And I think we must try to sort of work against faith schoolings, particularly in the UK, which in fact we have a Minister for Education who used to be a member of Opus Dei and a Prime Minister who apparently seems to think he's answerable to God for his acceptance of going into Iraq and this nature. There are problems with politicians, and I hope that we can hear this.
Okay, welcome back. We're ready to resume our discussion of the 105th Congress during your visit here for inauguration. And we're very pleased to have with us the Senate Majority Leader, Trent Lott of Mississippi, if you'd help us welcome us.
Thank you.
Okay, we should. Oh, sorry about that. Okay, it's gone again. And for some reason.
Okay, welcome back. We're ready to resume our discussion of the 105th Congress during your visit here for inauguration. And we're very pleased to have with us the Senate Majority Leader, Trent Lott of Mississippi, if you'd help us welcome him.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. I would like to know, what advice would you give to a prospective student who is interested in following a career path similar to a senator?
Similar to a senator?
Yes.
Well, first of all, I want to encourage you to take maximum advantage of your educational opportunities. We live in a great country, and we have a great educational system that's not perfect. We spend an awful lot of money that doesn't always give us the results that we want. But I can assure you, whatever you want to do in life, education will help you get a faster start. For instance, when I was in high school, if you were in the so-called pre-college curriculum, you had to take 4 years of science and 4 years of math. A waste of my time, a waste of the teacher's time, and a waste of space. You know, I took physics. For what? Every physics teacher in America is out to lynch me. Physics is great, and I think we need the best possible physics teachers and the best students in physics we can get if you're going into physics or mathematics or science or medicine. But if you want to be a lawyer and you know that's where you're headed, maybe you'd be better off taking an economics course, a typing course, a computer course, or music, for heaven's sake, because it's good for the soul.
There are a number of lessons to be gained from that. And the first is he was giving the kids a mandate not to know anything about the science and engineering and maths, which actually underpins their whole lives. He stopped. He was a master. He knew he'd done this before. He waited for the applause. All those kids were applauding. It was terrible. It is terrible. But worst of all was, music is good for the soul, but science and maths isn't. And so we have those sort of massive problems against us. There's another group, and it's, I think, a fifth column within the scientific community. What did we find in the cosmic barrel without premeditated ideas? We had no idea this molecule was there, and yet we discovered it. And that led to this place. I drew this when I was about 13. It's Stockholm Town Hall, and I ended up shaking hands with this guy. At the same time, cold fusion was out there. And in fact, the first five papers that were written about our work said we were wrong. And I went through them carefully. I knew that we would one day prove them incorrect. But cold fusion was quite interesting because they were looking for cold fusion. And I think they did an experiment and they thought they'd seen it. I think they at the start, they certainly were, I think, honest scientists. And there's no possibility of us disproving that they didn't actually see cold fusion at that time. I think it's unlikely. Almost all the scientific community doesn't believe it, and yet I understand that some people do, that there was cold fusion. Now, what else can we find in the barrel, the cosmic barrel, with premeditated ambitions? Well, I say there is an infinite amount of junk at the bottom of the cosmic barrel, and those who scrape around in it will surely find a half-eaten apple. If that search is carried out with a mind clouded by the mystical fog of childhood teaching, in an attempt to resolve the plethora of philosophical problems that I had, that all of us have, one will just as surely convince oneself that the bit of apple bears Adam's teeth marks. I think that's the same almost as cold fusion in many ways. And here's a friend of mine, Charlie Towns, a fantastic scientist, really, one of the greatest contributions of the 20th century is the laser, maser, to optical surgery, to communications. He wrote a wonderful book on microwave spectroscopy, my field. I've read it cover to cover, eloquently written. And he wrote an article. He ended up in London receiving the Templeton Prize. Now, I am pretty sure that he wouldn't have won that prize had he not been Charlie Towns, because I asked him, I interviewed him, he said he wasn't quite sure. He wrote an article about it, and I think there are lots of articles out there, and I'm somewhat surprised that that was the case. Now, I'm not going to say anything what I think myself, but this is something of the power of the internet, because if you look at the Templeton Prize on some websites, when one accepts money or prizes from the Templeton Foundation, one's name becomes inextricably linked, not only logically, but also explicitly on their website with their philosophy, their goals, and their efforts. But I do think it is worth pointing out that the consequences of association with the Templeton Foundation, and to hope that, at the very least, scientists who do not subscribe to Templeton's views of science and religion won't allow their names to be used in support of them. For example, here is a quote by Templeton himself. From a theological perspective, it is indeed tempting to see this remarkable self-organizing tendency as an expression of the intimate nature of the Creator's activity and identification with our universe. There are strong hints of ultimate realities beyond the cosmos. One of the strongest hints, in our opinion, relates to the new understanding of the creativity of the cosmos, its capacity for so-called self-organization. It's not me saying this. It's out there on the internet. Sean Carroll, a physicist of the University of Chicago, declined an invitation to speak at a Templeton-sponsored conference held last fall, which featured 16 Nobel laureates and was endorsed by the APS. Carroll explained in his blog that the entire purpose of the Templeton Foundation is to blur the line between straightforward science and explicitly religious activity, making it seem like the two enterprises are part of one big undertaking. Carroll admitted that he had been tempted by the $2,000 honorarium. Eugene said, if I'm given 1.5 million bucks by the Church of England to support Christianity, I'm pretty sure I don't have the will to resist. Yes, I'm weak, but 1.5 million bucks is a lot of money. I don't have enormous problems with the beliefs of people who think that science and religion don't overlap, although I know that many of you do. My problem is with their methodology. However, money is useful, as I will demonstrate to anyone who wants to give me some. There are great kids, young, and I think these are pretty young people out there. Now, I have some messages, and I want for the Templeton Foundation that I think it would get a great deal of value if it actually gave the next year's award to Richard Dawkins. Now, I think that would indicate something, and that it really does want to actually bring science and religion and comparisons as they claim. So that's my first piece of advice. And by the way, Richard, if they do give it you, I want 10% of the, at least a crate of wine. Anyway, but those are the situations. Now, something that always troubled me was Einstein and his statements about God. And the rabbi asked Einstein to simply, do you believe in God? He said, and I thought this was a wonderful statement, I believe in Spinoza's God, who reveals himself in the orderly harmony of what exists, not in a God who concerns himself with fates and actions of human beings. I found that a very profound statement. And I was actually in San Diego some time ago, and in a bookshop I found this book on Spinoza, and I thought that was interesting. So who was this guy? Spinoza lived in Amsterdam. Oh, by the way, it's a book called Spinoza in 90 Minutes by Paul Strather. And 90 Minutes was about as much as I would give a philosopher, actually, at the time. But after today's fantastic presentation on Spinoza, I'm going to give it maybe 100. I'm going to get that book. He sent a letter to the synagogue authorities. He outlined in precise detail his philosophical views, backing them with logical arguments which he claimed were irrefutable. The synagogue authorities decided they had no alternative. They would have to demonstrate to the Christian community that they no longer would have anything to do with this guy. As far as they were concerned, Spinoza was a non-person, an ex-Jew. In a grand ceremony of excommunication, Spinoza was banished from the Jewish community. A great horn was blown, candles were extinguished one by one, and a curse was read out. With the judgment of angels and saints, we hereby excommunicate, execrate, and anathematize Baruch de Espinoza, and cursed be he by day. There's no sound. Okay. Oh, well, let's improvise. Okay. Let's go back. No sound. Can we do anything about the sound? Oh, that's we can take the sound. Okay, I had some sound for you. And cursed be he by night. He's lying down. Kirsten is rising up. Kirsten is rising up. The Lord shall destroy his name under the sun. You've got to improvise in this technical world. Under the sun, and cut him off for his undoing from all the tribes of Israel. None may speak with him by word of mouth, nor by writing, nor show any favor to him, nor by be under one roof with him, nor come within four cubits of him, nor read any document written by him. Well, I mean, you know, I'm a 60s guy. I've just got to read this guy. But unfortunately, it's in Latin. Okay. Now, Paul Strathern makes this statement, a universal God who can be properly apprehended only by the application of reason to the world around us. This suggests that Spinoza's religion of disenchantment could, in fact, be a prescient description of modern science, a pantheistic universe whose truth we can apprehend only by the use of reason, mathematics, and rational experiment. I'm now very happy to realize that Spinoza is not even pantheistic. So that was where we start. I've done a few things, and I want to give you some examples of my little attempts to do something. And that is, I've interviewed a lot of Nobel laureates, including Charlie Townes, and talked to him about the Templeton Foundation. But I'll just give you one. These are all people, and one is Herb Kroemer, and hopefully bring this down, okay? Okay, I've got to get into the right bit of this, which is, I think, about here.
Insight into the world and why it's here.
No.
That's quite definite. No, I seem to
yes.
hear. You have no belief that there's an afterlife.
That's correct.
And in the pattern of elementary particles and the constants that I mentioned and so on, you don't see the evidence of a designer.
No, I don't.
I think. Could you say more about it?
I think this is wishful thinking.
Wishful?
Yes. I mean, if some people, if they ask, and there are some people who see the evidence of some sort of design, and I just do not accept that thinking. I have no desire whatsoever to push this view on others. And if you hadn't asked me about this, I wouldn't have mentioned it. But I'm also not reluctant to say so when I'm asked.
Now, I've discussed this with, and we have discussed it with a lot of Nobel Prize winners, and it's about 9-1 against, and they're mainly atheists. And that's, I think, it's on the internet, on our website, and one can start to at least propagate some of the views of people who are scientists. And that has been one of my aims. The problem for me is is that there's not really much difference between the irrationality of the firm believer dedicated to humanitarian and socially responsible activity and the fundamentalist extremists. They're just interpreting the mystical indoctrination they have had in different ways. Now, Deborah McKenzie in The New Scientist offers some sage advice for those free thinkers who argue rationally with fundamentalist thought but make little headway. The challenge for the secular inheritors of the Enlightenment is to remain true to their values and to be tolerant and pluralistic, even in the face of an opponent who can never reciprocate. That means understanding fundamentalist mentality and at least not adding to the alienation that inspires the more extreme among them, something that I have a problem doing, I must admit. We must accept seriously held public belief as a normal part of modern living, says Davy. The more you deny and attack it, the more defensive it gets. So what are we to do? And I think an indication for me is the present Pope. I can't understand how he can see me as an enemy, but he does. A leading contender to become the next Pope, which was before he was the Pope, launched a fierce attack on the forces of secularism yesterday, arguing that they were fostering intolerance in Europe and forcing Christianity underground. Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, 77, one of the Vatican's most powerful figures, issued a rallying cry to the faithful saying that the liberal consensus had now evolved into a worrying and aggressive ideology. I think it's true. It's very difficult for me to put myself in his place. I assume that he truly believes that we are the most dangerous people as far as the Catholic Church. And certainly a large number of his flock do. And I think it's true that many of the Muslims, I mean, they must really see the West or some of us in America as dangerous to themselves as I think we do see them, as Sam and I feel that same way too. I don't understand that, but I think it's something that we have to recognize. And now, of course, he is the Pope. So I've been involved in a global citizenship program. It's really only just starting because it seems to me that we need to weld a sort of humanity sans frontier. I don't know how we can do that. And decide on our goals and recognize that confronting religion may be counterproductive. I don't know, some people would say. However hard it is, there may be more to gain by clenching our teeth and collaborating with those truly humanitarian factions, whatever persuasion they might have. And I'm involved in trying to set up a website for Albert Einstein and Joseph Rotblat. Joe is the greatest man I ever knew personally, and to try to put their anti-nationalism, anti-patriotism, and in fact their anti-religious attitudes and somewhere up on, as an agenda. I come now to my fantastic colleague, John Cornforth, who wrote an article which is on this website on scientists and citizens, and he writes so eloquently, "The scientist's true strength is something which I can put no better than Shaw in his all-but-forgotten play Back to Methuselah. But my ways did not work. And theirs did. And they were able to tell me why. That is their strength over me. They seek no other power. Scientists, says Capper, need to try harder to show that true strength, which is essentially is that they thrive on being doubted. In this they differ from all others among the shapers of society. We have to show that, you know, penicillin, these are the bacteria that are breaking up because the shell can't break. And that in 9 days, this girl was actually essentially cured. We've got to talk to our young people and show the humanity of chemistry, the humanity of the sciences. In fact, this is amputation without anesthetics. And just get them to think what it was like in that old world without the sciences. I do workshops with small children. These are 8 to 9-year-olds in Mexico. I'm doing it on the internet now. I did one last Monday, to Venezuela. I couldn't go to Venezuela. Science is universal, as we've all know. I mean, science is the only truly universal culture, whatever your color. I love this picture from a couple of kids in one of my little workshops. Whatever your personal philosophy or that of your parents. This was in Malaysia. And this kid was is in Iceland. I couldn't go to Iceland, but they sent me this photograph of the workshop, buckyball workshop that I did to Iceland. Scientists as citizens Kappa addresses some shortcomings as well of the scientific community. It's not just all good. He does that as well. I set up a website many years ago, and what was the aim? To create a platform for scientists to communicate directly without the medium of a media mogul. This is it. We've got discussion programs, lectures, careers programs, interviews, workshops for young children, teachers' resources, and major issues. We deal with a lot of things. Every year I have another thought, I'll do something else. I'm free to do with this website what I want and let scientists say what they want. On the scientific discussion, we've pioneered a new concept in TV debate. Participants should actually understand the subject. You know what I mean. We've got careers programs, A Day in the Life of a Young Scientist. We're discussing DDT. It's probably saved, I don't know, 500 million lives. How many? We don't know. This is the man's greatest enemy, actually. It's killing 2 million kids every year in South Africa. Let's get a perspective on this. We've got Max Perutz, who got the structure of hemoglobin. Joseph Rotblat, who spent almost all his life trying to stop the spread of nuclear weapons, died when he was 97, just last year. He was the greatest man I ever knew personally. We interviewed him, and he's on our website. We've got programs on the brain.
The head go transparent, revealing the outside of the brain. Perhaps you can get a sentiment of the power of the technique, because now we're visualizing those water molecules that have memory constants characteristic of brain rather than facial muscle tissue. Well, our resident skeptic may say, look, you could do that on the slab in a post-mortem room, but I'd like to hope I can be forgiven for not submitting myself to the inconvenience of that particular experiment. Anyway, it's bad practice to teach graduate students to do experiments that they can't repeat several times.
Humor's also good, and people think that scientists are not humorous and can't tell jokes. These are the people who've helped me, John Hare, Chris Dean, Chris Ewells, Ed Goldwyn, Richard Inskin, Joe Watson, to create this particular site. But I want to now go to some new technology that you can all have in your own office. There are new technology where you can make programs yourself and put them onto a URL. This is one of them. And you can have the video on one side and the PowerPoint or whiteboard on the other. And we're experimenting from a Florida state. And one reason why I'm there is they are helping me to experiment with the way that individuals can help teachers to teach better. And I think we have to teach science and show the power of it, as Kappa says, that it thrives on being doubted. I call it geo. I do logos. I mean, that's a logo for Buckyballs Down Under. And this is one for the GEO, Global Educational Outreach. Now, why have I got a little bit of optimism? In summary, I think the Enlightenment is under threat as powerful and well-funded forces wage war on modern humanitarian philosophies and our values based on doubt, questioning, and reason, in particular the sciences. I don't know, the Center for Inquiry may have 25 million. It pales into insignificance compared to 400 million for the Campus Crusade for Christ, and 88 billion which people put into the religious institutions on top of what they've already got. But we're still there. Manipulation of the democratic process is now well underway as fundamentalists take control of education, intelligent design, single-phase schools, the media, God Channel, Fox TV. The law, Supreme Court, blasphemy, they're trying to bring in put the blasphemy law and make it sort of apply to Islam in the UK. Government, Bush, Blair, Nigeria, Iran. The war, however, and I think this is the important point, is fragmented in that it is being waged in different regions by a variety of movements which have one thing in common, blind faith in fundamentalist dogma. These anti-democratic movements are intrinsically antagonistic, however, as they generally are intensely nationalistic and therefore exert only parochial influence. Throughout all these regions, exist vast numbers of individuals who share an alternative but common philosophy, rationality. These people have a cross-national, multicultural, and global coherent cultural identity. One figure is this one from Hawaii. I was really staggered that unaffiliated up here, the Green Lot, is actually higher than Christian, Buddhist, Jews, and others. Okay, I believe that there are people out there. And I gave a lecture like this in Tallahassee, and the most wonderful moment was this elderly gentleman came to see me and said, you know, I don't feel so alone anymore. And I think what Richard found is there are people that we need now to say, we've got to come out. This is a sort of McCarthy era against not so much atheism, but people who don't accept Christianity or whatever. And I think we should do something about it. The global reach of the internet and the possibility of mobilizing action on a global scale may offer a ray of hope in withstanding the assault that is now underway. Through the internet, one can instantaneously communicate with people worldwide who share this common philosophy. I think the last chance is to find a way in which members of this global community can coordinate their efforts to save the secular safeguards that have been won since the time of Galileo and are implicitly stated in the most wonderful document, the U.S. Constitution, by Jefferson and Thomas Paine and Adams and Benjamin Franklin. And I think we've seen some effect, and that is, it worked against apartheid. There was a sort of global altruistic approach which said, this is wrong, let's do something about it, and Exxon Valdez. It should be possible to move all our efforts in those ways. Distortion of the democratic process, regent of school of law, Pat Robertson's university, focuses on journalism and law. News Corporation. I love this channel. They always agree with every word I say. Okay. We see God channels all over the place. I mean, I just can't believe it. And these things are out there. We need a C-SPAN for science. And Roger, I think we've got to help you to actually get this thing on the road, backed up by an internet channel. My heroes, well, we talked about heroes. I don't know that I like heroes, but let's just call them heroes because I can't think of a better one. Joe Rotblat. He was the Nobel Peace Prize winner for his work with Pugwash. Okay, absolutely fantastic guy. Go to our website and listen to him talk. Jacob Bronowski, The Ascent of Man. There's never been a better set of programs for science. Here he is playing with his grandson. Carl Sagan, fantastic book. I carry this wherever I go. And if you want to know the dangers of not doubting, they're in this book. I like this one. Of the great commands of science, mistrust arguments for authority. That's one of my heroes, too, but not the old geezer who's as decrepit as I am now, but the young guy. He was actually 17 when he first started thinking. I mean, this is the problem. Science is tarred by the image of the old guy. And these are some of mine, Jim Heath and Sean O'Brien, who actually helped us to make the discovery of C60. Young scientists, Yuan Liu now at Oak Ridge, and Jonathan Hare in the UK. These are the people that we should be celebrating and putting out there as iconic images for young people to actually follow. Unfortunately, it's not that. It's people like this guy. And he's a Scientologist, okay? Now, that's a serious problem, it seems to me. How is this? Well, we should be celebrating people like Richard Feynman. The freedom to doubt is an important matter in the sciences, I believe, and in other fields. It was born out of a struggle. It was a struggle to be permitted to doubt, to be unsure. And I do not want to forget the importance of that struggle and by default let it fall away. If you know you're unsure, you have a chance to change the situation. I like this. I want to demand this freedom for future generations. I think we've got a problem in saving that. I think we're stepping backwards and we must do something about it. I come to the USA and therefore to some extent starting to immerse myself a little bit in American culture. But this is the most cogent statement of science I've ever seen. I like the scientific spirit, the holding off, the being sure, and this is the wonderful line, but not too sure. That encapsulates science. The willingness to surrender ideas when the evidence is against them. This is ultimately fine, and this fantastic statement at the end, it keeps the way beyond open. It is a tremendous perceptive statement about science, which I haven't seen any scientist make so well. Thomas Paine, well, I have to show it because he lived in my hometown, Lewis. My Margaret and I live near here, about a mile from this house. I know it says the rights of man. Well, we've got the rights of man and woman, men of humanity. You will do me justice to remember that I have always supported the right of man to his own opinion, however different that opinion be from mine. He who denies another this right makes a slave of himself to his present opinion, because he precludes himself the right of changing it. I have a problem with this, but I know it's right when I talk to someone who's strongly religious. We have to recognize this, and I don't know how we do reconcile that. Anyway, the biggest problem I see in the USA, the change from the early 60s, the swinging 60s, the time when we lived in Canada for 2 years, in the States for a year, is something that I think you'll see in Benjamin Franklin. Michael Kasher, my friend at FSU, showed me this. He pointed out this wonderful page. The Indians were exceedingly gracious to strangers, setting aside a special house in each village to accommodate visitors, and were exemplars of toleration. Franklin wrote of a missionary who told the Susquehanna the story of Adam's fall and how it had led to great travail and necessitated Jesus' suffering and death. When he had finished, an Indian orator stood up to thank him. Franklin related with a twinkle in either his own eye or the Indian's, "What you have told us is all very good. It is indeed bad to eat apples. It's better to make them all into cider." I think the US over the last few years has lost its sense of humor, at least up there on television. The comedy programs aren't there. I don't see it in the politics. And I think life without a sense of humor is wasted. So basically, I suddenly realized our little boy, David, once said something that always rings, and I always remember saying, "Them that dies be the lucky ones." I think that's atheism for you. Thank you very much.
I knew pretty much most of what you were going to say, but I didn't know about the bit about the Templeton Foundation. And since he has to catch a plane, I think it... Charles Harper, since you're here, would you like to respond? Sure. Would you like to actually come up and talk for a few minutes?
All right. I'll give it a go.
Hey, Sam Harris and Scott are trying
to... I only gave advice to the Templeton Foundation. I never said anything myself. Yes,
I have to leave in 10 minutes. So
okay.
It's not quite an opportunity to reply. This has been an interesting experience for me, and I do find it strange. I do think there's a heuristic that a number of people are trapped into, and Ian Barber describes this in his Gifford lectures, the idea that people tend to think of the relationship of science and religion in terms of certain set categories, certain heuristics. The most common one, and the one that I think dominates much of the discussion, is the general idea that there's warfare or a Whiggish relation of replacement, new priests replacing old priests, neo-Protestants replacing neo-Catholics. I think one of the challenges that I face is precisely the power of this heuristic, the way that people believe in this general idea that science is the enemy of faith, and the enemy, and that its flourishing requires the extirpation of religious thought or religious scholarship. I will try to maybe jump through a few slides, but I'll just go very quickly.
Charles, could I actually just interrupt for a second? Neil just pointed out that I rather ungraciously didn't fully introduce you. I just thought people assumed that we knew who you were. Charles Harper is actually Senior Vice President of the John Templeton Foundation people, and he was originally trained in engineering, philosophy, and then he went to University
That's
of Oxford.
That's all right.
As we know that you've got a
I am a scientist,
science
actually,
yeah.
And I came to the Templeton Foundation from Harvard. Before that, I was at NASA. And so probably the most important science I did is I developed the modern techniques for dating the Earth, Moon, and Mars. I developed the hafnium-tungsten technique, the isotope technique, the samarium-neodymium double chronometer, and the niobium-zirconium chronometer. And those are used for dating the origin of Mars, the giant impact for dating the Moon, and core formation on the Earth. I also was involved in dating the galaxy in nucleocosmochronology and in in a number of projects having to do with nucleosynthesis, both Big Bang and stellar. And I spend most of my time actually creating scientific research funding projects. So before I came to this meeting, I was involved in a day-long exercise of developing a project, probably about $5 million in evolutionary biology. This will be a project about the evolution of or archaeological research on when the first intimations of religious type or spiritual type behavior. For example, in Ethiopia, there's the oldest skull of Homo sapiens found at Herto, and it's 160,000 years old. Tim White has excavated it, and it's polished. It actually has characteristics such as you'd find on a skull in New Guinea. And there, as you know, are burials at about 100,000 years in caves in Israel. So my typical daily work is to develop scientific research projects that relate to great questions. They're often going across the barrier to something to do with religion, either the evolution of religiosity or primatology related to issues like forgiveness, or in my own field in astrophysical cosmology, really big questions like why the laws of physics exist, why is nature mathematical, is there one universe or a multiverse? So Ian Barber is very useful in pointing out that there are these typologies that people typically use to think about the relationship, to simplify the complexity of life, and to some degree to ignore the scholarly literature of history and sociology and so forth in order to have generic ideas about the relationship. The most common, again, is one of conflict. The other one that's been mentioned, I think that Steven Weinberg claimed that it's the Templeton Foundation's position of generic separation or noma. The California hot tub vision would be eventual integration of science and religion. Now, Barber's position, and it would certainly be that of the Templeton Foundation, is that dialogue is the more responsible general idea, that one shouldn't jump into these simplifying categories. It's non-simplistic, non-fundamentalistic thinking, actually. It requires wide-ranging learning. It's not easy. And it requires engagement with a substantial and growing interdisciplinary literature. And it seeks to adjudicate disputes in a disciplined and scholarly manner wherever appropriate. So in terms of reform agendas, Sir John Templeton is actually a very strong critic of his own tradition and is always arguing about the importance of science, the importance of funding science, the importance of teaching religious people about science, the significance of the rational method in science and the empirical method in science. This is my task from Sir John Templeton. It's ironic to be attacked because one has the perception in this kind of heuristic of warfare that you're either with him or against him, you're on one side or the other. My job actually involves creating all sorts of different types of funding projects for scientific research and for dialogue and for scholarship in history and sociology and so forth to illuminate and deepen these kinds of discussions. I must say that many of these discussions that we've had are not very deep in an intellectual sense. There's a wealth of literature and history and sociology and so forth that has not really been drawn upon in these discussions. All right, let me just jump back. Okay, I wanted to bring a counterpoint to your attention, and that counterpoint is some reasons why ideological scientism may be problematic for science. Some definitions, scientism. That would be the philosophy which propounds science to be a philosophy or a worldview or a cultural reform agenda or a comprehensive way of life. So after the French Revolution, there were many experiments in these kinds of ideas, the religion of science, of Comte being one of them. Ideological scientism, the ideology which projects itself into cultural politics as being representative of science, but which does not utilize the scientific method, which is not constrained by the usual institutional rigor of scientific research publishing, and which is not delimited to scientific matters and is meta-scientific and ideological in nature. Now, why did I use the word commercialized? I'd like to ask the question, why so many attack books now? There's an obvious context of present national politics. We've heard that in the last 2 days. And of course, the intelligent design dispute has become politicized and people are interested. But I think that it can't be ignored that attack books as a phenomenon are a business. John Brockman, who's a hero of popularization of science, he is a businessman, and attack books are well marketed by their publishers, and they can be lucrative for authors agents, publishers, and booksellers. These books are being cranked out because they're a business. They're not scholarly monographs. They're a business. So it's been a successful publishing strategy since the 1920s. That's conflict sells, especially conflict with religion. So scientism is not science. When scientists stand up and speak about what ought to happen in the world, or about war and peace, or about intellectual affairs, or what ought to happen with the education of children, they are speaking as citizens, not necessarily as representatives of the scientific method or scientific culture. So scientism is problematic for the public, because it confuses people as to what real, that is vocational science, really is. So for example, the origin of the intelligent design movement in America is based on reading The Blind Watchmaker by a professor of law at Bolt Hall, Berkeley. It was reading that book that persuaded Philip Johnson to engage in this quest of creating what became the intelligent design movement, because he actually believed that evolutionary biology is the position in that book. Now, science itself almost never obtains ideological or philosophical conclusions. God does not exist, or atheism is true. These are never scientific statements following from scientific research. You won't find them published in technical journals. But science popularization includes a very strong bias towards ideological disputes and meaning issues. Now, there's a problem of naivete. And when scientific communities go beyond their domain of intrinsic expertise, and when they become ideologically engaged, it's typical that what results is naive, in a sense of it being disconnected from the best relevant scholarship. Now, science in its core activities typically exemplifies a remarkable, indeed, an astonishingly rigorous discipline in its research publication. Scientific research publishing seeks an extremely high standard for factual accuracy, but this high standard of rigor is dropped, typically, when scientists move from science to scientism. Now, science in its details is, I would argue, impossible to communicate to the public in most cases because it's hyper-technical in nature. If you take at random journals off the shelf, the astrophysical journals, Science or Nature, at random open an article, even if you're a scientist, you'll rarely really understand what's there. So science is like Mongolian for everybody in the technical details of what it actually is. So science popularizations tend to portray a sense of vision or meaning of what science is like to the public. And there's a skewing there of what science actually is with respect to what people think it is. So enthusiasms that are based on pop conflict books are intrinsically unrepresentative of the scientific enterprise as it actually is through its research publication and its laboratory activities. And the media tends unrepresentatively to amplify the conflicts-focused perspectives portrayed in these books. They arguably are an inaccurate basis by which to portray the work and significance of scientific institutions to an interested public. So I would ask, is it a good method of representation to science, to the non-scientific public, to seem to suggest that the core agenda of science is to attack extra-scientific aspects of culture that are for many people the carriers of their deepest and most cherished values? Is that good policy? And do ideological assaults against religion well represent science to a broadly religious public, but also a public that over the past century in the US has supported a massive expansion of scientific research totally unprecedented in human history? So hot debates are fine. I'm certainly not arguing against hot, exciting debates in culture and in the domain of philosophy and politics. But in terms of representing science, there is a problem. If the public thinks that that's what science is. So it's easy to make fun of ordinary people. In a democracy, however, these ordinary people that it's easy to make fun of, they pay the bills to some degree for scientific research. It's important for the future of science for people to have an interest in and an enthusiasm for and gratitude to science. Now, there's a deep reserve of gratitude to science in the United States. Ordinary people have many reasons to be deeply grateful, but it might not be excessively unreasonable if science, when it faces the public, is careful to engage the public with some degree of reciprocal gratitude for the wonderful opportunities to do scientific research, often at public expense. It's a diplomacy issue. I'll just carry on. Now, some downside possibilities of the widespread misrepresentation of science as scientism in the United States. It involves mass misrepresentation of science to the public, certainly in the case of evangelical Christians. One could have erosion of support for public expenditure for scientific research. It hasn't happened, but it is possible. One certainly has a loss of many brilliant young people to science by being alienated and their non-entry because of that alienation. I think of the loss of the powerful connection of wonder that boosts public interest in science, and that's very important in relation to how religious people, religiously raised people, look at science. A sense of wonder is very important. I have colleagues in Italy who are very concerned that children are not going into physics, because they are not able to draw on a sense of wonder that connects with their deepest values. And it's the case in Milan that most of the entries into the physics department are members of religious movement called Communio, where the sense of wonder about nature is cultivated. Now, big issue, the neglect of the dilemma of power. I would argue that it's hubris to imagine that science as science solves the ethical challenges of human history. The big ethical challenges of human history will require the involvement of masses of people everywhere, as well as all sorts of leaders, and most of whom will not be scientific leaders, and some of whom will be religious. Now, what do I mean by the dilemma of power? I would define it in the following way. The dilemma of power is the fact that science and technology create new forms of power rapidly, whereas cultures and civilizations do not so easily create the parallel capacities of stewardship required to utilize newly created powers for benevolent use and to restrain them from being used to serve malevolent ends. This is an icon of the challenge of the scientist facing the dilemma of power. Of course, you know Einstein on the right. Many of you will know that that's Fritz Haber on the left. Half of the food that we eat exists because of the fixation of nitrogen to create ammonia that the Haber-Bosch process made possible in large industrial developments. Now, Fritz Haber also created Zyklon B. So from A to Z, ammonia to Zyklon B, Fritz Haber is an icon of the dilemma of power for the modern scientist. A creative modern scientist can create the greatest good in the world and the greatest evil. To be a scientist is to be involved with this birth of new power in the world. Now, a little bit about the foundation, Templeton Foundation. We're mid-sized. Most of what we do is not the Templeton Prize. It's less than 2% of our activity. So we're not advocates for religion at all. We're not advocates for the Christian religion. And we work with atheists, agnostic theists. We have programs in Islam. We have programs in Judaism, all over the place with Hindus and Buddhists. So our tagline is supporting science, investing in the big questions for our science funding component. And our mission is described as to be a catalyst for discoveries engaging life's biggest questions. And we tried in our motto to be humble. Humility is the core virtue that Sir John Templeton has encouraged us to have. It's about learning. It's about discovery. So how little we know, how eager to learn. Now, what do we fund? Okay, we fund scientific research that's specifically focused on deep, ultimate, or boundary issues. So we fund in cosmology, we fund in evolutionary biology on issues like the debate over directionality and teleonomy in nature. We also fund on typically spiritual topics like forgiveness or love or joy. We fund a lot of research in evolutionary biology. Probably in the last 5 years, we've funded $10 million through peer-reviewed grants competitions in evolutionary biology in the area of altruism. And that includes grants to people like Pascal Boyer, Robert Sapolsky, Franz de Waal, maybe Richard Wrang, I'm not sure. But
Charles, would you be careful to leave some time for questions because I know that you have to scoot a bit.
So that's it. Thank you for your attention.
Okay. And just to make absolutely clear, there is no Templeton funding at this meeting either. So.
Let me just say a couple of things, because in response, because I didn't realize I would have preferred to have
responded after the presentation. What I said, I just presented what's out, and I wanted to show the power of the internet and that there are young people who obviously do not understand. They perceive from what the Templeton Foundation is doing something which I thought hopefully will help you to recognize that your messages of, you know, what your aims are is what you say they are here is not obvious to the people on the outside. The second thing I gave another piece of advice is if you really feel that you are helping, then I really do think people like Richard and many other people in this particular audience really are people who are looking very, very carefully at the problems that religion has, Sam Harris as well. So I think you will gain great legitimacy for your claims if you were to consider these people for the next prize. What I said, I never said anything. I mean,
it's based on judges and nominations. So the way that somebody wins the Templeton Prize is they're nominated from the outside. The Templeton Foundation isn't involved in nominations. And then a set of distinguished judges makes a decision.
Well, there is a big difference between, say, the Nobel Prize and the Templeton Foundation. One does notice that the prize this year was awarded to someone who'd been a governor on the governor's board and also on the board of trustees for up the order of 10 years. I'd also like to ask, I mean, with regard to Charlie Towns, who I think is a very great scientist, what actual major contribution has he made that would compare, say, with his contribution to science, which is just a fantastic one? I think there is a big difference between the way the Nobel Prize, which is arguably not well awarded, as probably someone would have say, as I got it anyway. I used to think that you had to be a smart and clever, and I've shown you today that I'm not that smart, so people who are not smart and clever can actually get this prize. But we are recommended worldwide by people of any nationality, from Japan, whatever their religion is, whatever. It's, in your case, it's awarded by a small group of people. Yes, nominations from the outside, but I found it quite staggering that in the CV of this year's awardee, someone I know very well, as I was on his appointing committee, that he'd been on the board of governors and a trustee of the foundation, and I think that's a problem for you.
Well, I will not. The Templeton Foundation, I think, the Templeton Prize is an eccentric prize, and I work with a billionaire who is eccentric. And I certainly will not move away from that. And in the case of Charlie Towns, I do think that Charlie Towns' scientific distinction moved the judges to make the award to Charlie Towns without the level of contribution of scholarship that I think John Barrow has demonstrated. I think John Barrow is an excellent and well-deserving winner of the prize. He was actually not a trustee at the time that he was awarded the prize, and it was important when the foundation recognized that he was under consideration, that his nomination was being taken seriously, that he stepped down. So, of course, John is close. He was he gave me my thesis idea, and he was my thesis examiner at Oxford University. But I do think that John Barrow won on the merits. I think that his scholarship was bold, innovative, and excellent. And so I do think that John is a well-deserving winner, but I certainly will agree with you that the Templeton Prize is not of the level of the Nobel Prize at all.
It's
an unusual effort of a billionaire to do something believing in prizes. I've often argued to him that prizes are not the best way to accomplish the ends that he hopes for.
I want to actually focus on what you talked about, the prize.
Lawrence, for a second, that's exactly what I wanted to say. I'm not interested in the esoteric of Templeton. I'm actually interested in the charge of scientism.
Well, exactly. Well, actually, the reason I and others have asked physicists never to take money from the Templeton Foundation, and where I will not, in spite of the fact that my research actually, as you know, is in areas precisely covered by it, is because of the fact that the organization is an organization based on scientism, in the along the definition you gave. It's specifically that if you look at the website of the Templeton Foundation, it says we fund this stuff, but implicitly in there is the claim that science can provide a sound basis for a belief in God, and that is scientism, and that's why I don't believe scientists should take money from your foundation.
That's not accurate, and I think that the reason that I started with Barber has to do with the philosophy that I promote. I don't govern everything at the Templeton Foundation, but the idea of dialogue. I think that science is a very important dialogue partner in informing these big questions. But I think that for any academic enterprise, usually it's the case that people with a particular guild expertise are the most relevant. So in debates over the significance of the laws of physics or the question of ultimate explanation, I think that philosophers who specialize in this are the most important people to fund, often to be in dialogue. So one of the areas I'm very interested in putting a lot of capital into is, for want of a better word, the philosophy of cosmology, because cosmology is making great and incredible strides, going in very deep directions, amazing things going on in cosmology. But you find the kind of public interpretation of these findings to be rather naive intellectually. But you don't find, as you do in quantum mechanics, a large number of very interesting transition people in philosophy. Cosmology typically doesn't have that. And it's interesting enough that there ought to be an interdisciplinary field where you have cosmologists, mathematicians, philosophers, philosophers of physics and math, and philosophical theologians engaged in this debate. Because naturally, in the discussion, say, about the multiverse, the so-called God question naturally arises. It is at the boundary. It's meta-scientific. And so our approach is to promote interdisciplinary communities of discourse. One of the problems of modern intellectual life is the intellectual division of labor. You have people that are more, as you know, more and more specialized in narrow areas of expertise. And one of the challenges is the problem of the gaps of crossing the different disciplines and uniting the different forms of knowledge and wisdom that exist in the academy but don't formally overlap. So you have forms of popularization that don't actually draw on the appropriate expertise. So part of our challenge is to bring the disciplines into research together. And so it's not a vision of scientism. It's not really asking scientists to stand up and pontificate about things outside of their expertise. In cases like John Polkinghorne or Arthur Peacock, who died 2 weeks ago, or Ian Barber, they're people that are bi-trained. They've actually invested their lives in training in both domains.
One of the things that John Brockman tries to do, whom you attacked as a businessman promoting attack books, he specifically does try to do interdisciplinary science. Talking of businessmen, Sir John Templeton is a billionaire, a businessman who has used his billions to subvert science.
You're in charge.
Right. Well, let's get Susan.
Or I'll take over.
No. Let's.
I actually yes, go ahead.
This is not about the Templeton Foundation, but it's about something that both of you in different ways referred to, namely, Einstein was brought up as an iconic figure. And I think at this point it might be really helpful to ask why Einstein has functioned as the icon of the 20th century, a much bigger pop star than Dylan or John Lennon or anybody else. It's not because, and this cuts across the board, it's really quite extraordinary to see how many people glom onto Einstein. It's not because they understand general relativity. It's not even because they're interested in general relativity. Now, there's a lot that one could say about it, but one of the things that I think is crucial to Einstein's role in the world is his absolute respect for everyone. This is to just about the, Templeton Foundation is leaving. I mean, this is not a matter of, being kind to ordinary people because they're the ones who might withdraw your funding. This is about a genuine and deep Enlightenment commitment to the idea that human beings are created equal and that that's not a myth. And we have plenty of stories that are apocryphal about Einstein having shown that in all of his behavior. It's a spirit that I have to say I've found missing in much of the discussion here. And even in your own really quite wonderfully intentioned attempts to create a transnational humanism, or whatever you want to call it, it's very hard to imagine Einstein ever making a statement like, well, we have to clench our teeth and work with whomever as long as they're on the right side. I think as long as one has that...
Not on the right side. I think, good. I mean, I think it's very difficult for many people. I mean, Einstein was a remarkable person. I accept that. If you look at his readings, but he was pretty strong statements about nationalism and patriotism. He made some very strong statements. And I think, in a sense, he was clenching his teeth, too.
No, he wasn't.
Well, maybe
he was. He was clenching his teeth about fascists. He was clenching his teeth
Einstein.
About McCarthy.
I'm me, and Richard is him, and you are you. I've got to talk to people very often and say, right, look, I'm rubbing this guy up the wrong way. I'm not going to convert some of my friends from their intense belief in Catholicism. Yet they're decent people. I think what I'm saying is that each individual, Einstein in his way, Richard in his way, you in your way, we now have, I think, what I was trying to say in my talk, and is not, I don't know the answer, but we have now a medium, another thing, which is in addition to the printing press, to enable individuals to express their creative attitude, in particular, to trying to get a more rational and helpful way in which we can live together. And I think people do that in very many different ways. Richard in writing his books, other people in writing this book. What I am doing in my small little way is enabling scientists to communicate on whatsoever they wish. If they want to be on their science, that's fine. There is now a new medium out there, which is what I wanted to talk about. And I think it's important that on my website, Charlie Towns is on there. I've not censored him, although I don't agree with him. And I discuss these issues very closely with him. And we discussed it with many others. And what I'm trying to say is there is this medium, which this is a wonderful group of people, who really do want to save the world in some way. I don't know how to do it, but I'm doing my little bit. It's quite hard to do it, because I don't have Templeton money. I wouldn't take it. I don't want it. I want the money to come from people who really want to say to save the secularity, the ability to have a dialogue with people who really, the new scientist said, we have almost no way. But we've got to work together if we're going to solve our problems.
All right. Just one sentence. I think.
How long is it?
Well, it's one sentence. I think that the kinds of qualities I was talking about are ways in which all of us could be an Einstein. So.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Richard, one last comment.
I'll change the clench the teeth.
And then what we're going to do is just have Andrea and finish off for you.
I'm Richard Sloan from Columbia University. I'm sorry, Charles.
Charles
Harper just left because I take deep offense at his comment that those of us who write books for public consumption are doing so only to make money. And I want him to know, I've already told him this in different ways, but I wrote my book, Blind Faith, about science and religion and science and medicine precisely to counter the garbage research that the Templeton Foundation has funded in the area of religion and medicine. I have had conversations with him about the quality of the research that they've supported, but hearing him suggest that I and others in this room who also ought to take tremendous offense at the suggestion that we're only writing to make money. If I make money, it'll be a surprise to me.
Thank you. Well, and you'll have a chance to, we'll be hearing about your work tomorrow as well. And would you like to?
Yes.
Sailors off into the night sky.
Just while Anne walks up to the front, if I can
don't
offer.
Miss an opportunity.
No, it's quick. It's quick.
No, don't. Go ahead.
I just want to say that the geodesic dome was not first designed by Buckminster. I just want to. We've had buckyballs. I was just going to give a correction.
Okay.
A very little known fact that the geodesic dome was invented by Zeiss, the optical company
I know
in
that.
East Germany. In 1923.
Yes. Let me just say that I do know that.
Do
and
that
there are photographs of it, and
yes.
But it didn't figure in my knowledge because it was all covered up.
Yeah.
So the geodesic structure was not known until some people found the photograph of it being built. That was actually one of a good friend of mine, which is.
But you know, that's all. I just wanted to clarify.
Wolfgang Kretschmer.
You know,
you're quite right.
I don't have to.
I mean, there are lots of other issues.
They just
there.
Invented it because they didn't have a round ceiling to project
well,
the new
right.
stars
but
that
it,
they had
it,
invented.
But it was the Buckminster Fuller Dome in Montreal that was in my mind. Okay, so it was the one that. Oh, yes, I'm here.
Do you have any water?
Oh, there's a water
under
there. Here, give that to Manny.
Thank you so much.
So this is Annie Drean, and what we have down here is that she's actually CEO of Cosmos Studios, but she worked on the Voyager Interstellar record, as I recall. She was in, wrote the movie, co-wrote the movie Contact. She worked on a number of Carl's things. She was a novelist in her own right, and also the Interstellar. What is it called now? The Interstellar.
I was a creative director of the Voyager Interstellar record, I think.
But I'm thinking about the solar sail.
Oh yes, and I also was project manager of the attempt at the first solar sail, and happy to say that I think we've raised the seed money for the next attempt at a solar sail. But I think I'm most proud of the fact that I was the co-writer of the Cosmos television series with Carl Sagan and Steve Soder. And it's my fate to speak to you when we're all in a collective blood sugar dive. And there's been a lot of talking. My heart was racing when I was listening to the previous speaker's comments, and I found myself becoming enraged. So I'm going to try to calm myself down and to speak rationally and to tell you where I'm coming from. And I want to tell you about my grandparents, who were the most profoundly religious people I have ever known. They were very poor. They were Latvian Jews, Orthodox Jews. And my grandfather was so devout that even when he was dying of stomach cancer, and he had a dispensation in the table of Jewish laws, the Shulchan Aruch, which said that he could ride on the Sabbath, he refused to do so. My grandmother, if a meat fork would accidentally come in contact with a dairy spoon, would run to the backyard to bury the offending utensil until it was once again a dairy fork. My grandparents were so poor that they couldn't afford the dues for the synagogue, and so my grandfather, in the coldest of winters in Queens, New York, was the watchman of the synagogue at night while it was being built, stood outside all night long to guard the synagogue. Now, my father is an atheist, and what's interesting about this is that my father and my grandparents had the most beautiful relationship. I never saw my father, who was an educated man, ever give his uneducated parents so much as even a dirty look. Not even, you know, an impatient moment. They adored each other. There was no hint of conflict between them, which I found amazing. Not at all like my mother's family. And so I once asked my father, how come you don't believe in God at all? Grandma and Grandpa believe in God with all their hearts and all their souls. And yet you seem in such great harmony with each other. And this is the story my father told me. And it has really set the course of my life. My father said that he came home from NYU after his first term there, rode the subway back to Queens, rehearsing all the way what he would say to my grandfather, comes into the house and finds my grandfather enveloped in his phylacteries and his tallis, deep in prayer at the kitchen table, davening. So deep in prayer that he didn't even notice that my father was standing there. My father, trembling, waited until my grandfather emerged from his trance. And when my grandfather opened his eyes and saw my father standing there, he smiled as if my father was the answer to his prayers. And he went up to kiss my father, and my father said, "Pop, no, stay back. I want to tell you something. I'm not going to pray anymore. I'm not going to keep kosher anymore. I'm not going to daven. I'm not going to go to shul. I'm not going to walk on Shabbos because it's all bullshit. I don't believe it, and I'm not going to do it anymore." So I said to my father, well, what did Grandpa say? And my father told me that his father looked at him and he said, well, the only sin would be to pretend. Now, that's a story that most people find very surprising, because we're so used to the idea that religious people would rather have us pretend, that religion is not really about the belief in God. I mean, my grandfather really believed in God, and so he felt that the idea of paying lip service was useless. It would be a lie. And that's, I think, such an exemplary instance of what that kind of devotion can be. It wasn't about social coercion. It wasn't about imposing, you know, your fear of death or your desire to be immortal or your desire to be special or belong to a special group. He wasn't afraid of the peer pressure that he would experience from his friends if they knew that his son didn't believe, because it was just about really believing. I've been very lucky, as you can see, in the people in my life. And my relationship with Carl Sagan, my 20 years, my 20 trips around the sun with him, was, of course, the most beautiful and blessed good fortune that I've ever had. Now, this, Deuteronomy has taken a real beating here today, as has Leviticus. But in Deuteronomy, there is something called the V'ahavtor prayer, which says that thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy might, and that these words that I command you this day, God is alleged to have said, you shall think of when you risest up, when you liest down, when you walkest by the way. And you should keep these words as frontlets between thine eyes. Well, as a kid, I didn't have any idea what frontlets were. I imagined they were sort of like sunglasses. But it was a notion that there was a way of seeing, that religion was a kind of a way of seeing, that you should keep, and everything should be seen through this filter, and it should be in your consciousness at all times. Now, there was a time when religion and science were one, before the modern scientific revolution. And, you know, anything that was even the antecedents of what science is today was done in a religious context. At that time, this fledgling science was called saving the appearances. That was really the job of science. It was to save the appearances, to save the religious story of nature, and not to conflict with it. So, for instance, Copernicus, he has a problem, and that is that the Earth-centered vision creates a calendar, which is impossible so to produce a reliable, consistent day to celebrate Easter. And so part of the reason that Copernicus takes on this problem is to develop a calendrical solution so that everyone can celebrate Easter on the same day. Well, of course, Copernicus and the other creators of the modern scientific revolution created a situation in which there was a great parting of the ways between science and religion. The religious view of nature was no longer a tenable story. And people who really wanted to understand nature were forced to depart from that, to go off on their own, to develop a new, thank you, what do we have here? Oh, it's very nice, and how British of you, really. Yummy. Very good for the throat, too. And so science takes off for the stars. Religion stays where it is, but it builds a kind of wall around itself to keep science out. And there's a kind of unspoken compact between science and religion. And religion is saying, science is saying, okay, you don't burn us at the stake anymore. You know, you let us do what we do to understand nature, and we'll cede that feeling of wonder. We'll cede the goosebumps to you, that feeling of oneness. And I think that this has been a failure of the scientific community, that for too long, it was unusual for the scientist to speak about how our knowledge of the natural world creates, has certain ethical, moral, and spiritual implications. And so there's this kind of, you know, people will, I'm not even sure what the word scientism really means. The way it was used earlier confused me. But I don't see how you can understand that there are 400 billion suns in this galaxy alone, each perhaps at the rate that we're finding extrasolar planets, each perhaps with a retinue of 100 worlds. And then go back to a book that talks of the world, when this is but one galaxy in so many other, in a universe of so many galaxies. There's a kind of, it's impossible to still read that book and not think that it's very earthbound in its conception of nature. And so that wonderful impulse that my grandfather had, I mean, he was so obviously devoted and true to what he believed. If he had had access to this wider cosmos that science has revealed, then I believe that he would have found new means of expression for his devotion and for his soulfulness. And I think that's what's happened to me, is to discover the world that science reveals, is to very much want to experience the transcendent, not give that up, but not do it by lying to myself about what it should be about, but instead take nature itself. I mean, the idea of a religion that's not rooted in nature, or a philosophy that's not rooted in what we know about nature, seems antithetical to the purpose of philosophy and of religion. I'd like to talk about one little experiment in cooperation between these often contentious views of existence, and that is the American Humanist Association in Florida came to me 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and said that they had, that they wanted to start, they wanted to apply for a charter for the first charter school in American history that would be a public humanist school. And they were going up against two fundamentalist Christian schools in Hillsborough County, Florida. And they wanted to call the school the Carl Sagan Academy. And read the charter, which was really impressive, joined forces with them. And we did go up against two fundamentalist schools. And the amazing thing is that the American Humanists had gone to every Baptist preacher in Hillsborough County and said, you know, we don't believe in God, but we'd like to give your children a state-of-the-art education in math and science, critical thinking, history of science, to break the cycle of poverty in Hillsborough County. We'd like your kids to be able to compete with kids anywhere in the country. And we enlisted the support of every single Baptist minister in Hillsborough County, went before the school board. The two fundamentalist charters were defeated, and our charter was accepted. And so we've been in existence for 2 years now. Our student body is entirely African American. If we survive to the third year, which looks like we will, we'll begin to get federal funding. We are the most improved school in Hillsborough County. Unfortunately, because of the abomination called No Child Left Behind, our curriculum, instead of being as science-centered as we hoped it would be, we're really playing catch-up because of the testing, the chronic testing on rote memorization that has become the curriculum of the American public school system. So I just want to say that when the earlier speaker was talking about popular books and having been a participant in probably one of the most successful worldwide efforts at popularization of public science education ever done, I felt very deeply resentful because there seemed to be a disconnect between one of his slides in which he decried popularization as being, you know, a distortion of science, and the other slide in which he talked about being nice to the public because they pay for science. When, in fact, because of the state of public education, it's only these efforts at popular education, because of the price also of higher education in this country and the fact that people who want to go to higher education but who don't have the money are effectively in putting themselves in indebtedness for the rest of their lives if they attempt to do so. These attempts, these books, popular science books and popular science television programs are one of the few efforts at breaking down that big, that wall around science, which has been so effective, so that we have a society completely dependent on science and high technology, and yet we have just a tiny number of people who understand the values and the method and the language of science, which in a country that or society that aspires to be a democracy is an absolute disaster. The gratification of the Cosmos television series, the number of people who have seen it worldwide, we have just made it available in Urdu. It's now available in something like 40 languages worldwide. It's been seen by 1 billion people domestically in the United States. The month of October was one of the largest sales months of largest sales in the history of the Cosmos television series. It's 27 years old. These have been 27 of the most eventful and fertile years in the history of science. How can it be that a science television series done in 1980 is still so compelling to so many people, more than it was in 1980? I believe that it's due in large part to the greatness of Carl Sagan, his ability to express with clarity complex subjects without cutting the corners on the science, his desire to communicate, not to impress anyone with his learnedness, but most of all, that combination of skepticism and wonder. None, not one, ever at the expense of the other, but each equally powerful. That is a very potent combination. It's the most powerful thing I know. And so I think it's really good for us to engage each other. I've enjoyed these talks over the last 48 hours. I've learned a tremendous amount. I've been stimulated, provoked, inspired. And I want to thank Roger. And I certainly want to thank everyone involved, all of the people who worked on making this conference possible for all of us. I think it's great for us to do these things. I just hope that that we are on the eve of a swing in the pendulum, that tomorrow we'll wake up and we'll realize that our fellow citizens have been aroused from their stupor, from their fear-based religion and their fear-based politics, to see what we have to do to make this tiny, very tiny, pale blue dot a place of peace and true goodness. Thank you.
Can I take any questions?
Oh, yeah, sure. Is anybody?
We'd be happy to take some questions.
Isn't everybody hungry and tired?
Or would you like to have that as a coda for the evening?
Please.
Questions.
Mark Lovendale, researcher, Preventive Care Institute.
The Cosmos series, I think, is an excellent example of how to get science out to the public. And we're in a situation where, as brought out in this meeting, where in this country, 53% of the people think that the world is around 6,000 years old. And somewhere over 60% of the people feel that, just have great trouble believing in evolution, as explained by Darwin. And in this country, we have this problem partially because of how powerful the religion is, but those numbers are also an indication of the failure, absolute failure, of the K through 12 educational system in this country. And the Cosmos series helped to get around that because the kids watch television. There's been other suggestions for getting around it. Milton Friedman came out with a system of a voucher system for schools that were non-religious private schools. And I wondered what your thoughts are for additional documentaries. I know Richard Hawkins, Dawkins have one in England that had a great impact there. And how can we get more of that type of thing on our television here to follow on the Cosmos type series?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, I think television is a reflection of who we are. I mean, I don't believe that that you can bring about the kind of change in the way that the media is or the way that our entertainment is except through awakening as many people as you possibly can. By, you know, everyone in this room has the power to communicate and to inspire. I've seen this now. And I think it's, you know, I think one of the tragedies of the scientific community is that people like Carl Sagan were persecuted for trying to do public education. Their scientific credentials were called into question. A guy like Carl, you know, who made some real scientific discoveries, who helped with others to pioneer whole fields of science, who was absolutely fearlessly interdisciplinary and willing to go on The Tonight Show, willing to publish in Parade magazine or any place where he could reach as many people as he possibly could. I think that that's what scientists have to be willing to do, but I also think that the community of science has to foster and encourage their colleagues to do such things. There can't be a penalty for public education. It should be a value of science. I mean, the thing that the religious community has so brilliantly down, as has been pointed out by other speakers, is human social organization. And, you know, I'd love to see every planetarium in this country one night a week to have local scientists come and do some kind of, you know, wonderful exploration that's accessible, no jargon allowed. Use the images as Neil did so brilliantly, as Carolyn did so brilliantly. Did you feel when Carolyn was doing her talk and showing those slides, that spiritual uplift that people felt? I mean, I think the previous speaker had been giving a very jargon-dense talk, if you forgive me, about something, and there was a kind of a, you know, a valley of energy, and then Carolyn came on, and that image of Saturn with the tiny one pixel Earth, and the rings of Saturn, gravity's rainbow, beautifully portrayed in that magnificent picture taken by a spacecraft. Well, let me ask you a question. How many people in the United States who paid for that picture ever got to see that picture? Why? There's this tragedy to it. Or for instance, in movies, think of the genius of our ability to simulate reality now visually, the verisimilitude that is possible in motion pictures. Think of our special effects gifts. And then think of how many times you've sat in a movie theater and saw those special effects utilized to depict the revelations about the cosmos that have come to us from modern science. And then think how many times those special effects have been used to blow up an automobile, or to blow up an airplane, or to blow up a city. It's unbelievable. If you were, you know, it's like us looking at the Aztecs who and saying, how could they rip out people's beating hearts? You know, didn't anybody realize, didn't they have any degree of self-consciousness and realize how absurd and horrible that was? Well, I think if someone looking at a future time looked at us and looked at how dependent we are on science and high technology and how alienated we are about science and how little we use our gifts to promote the scientific enterprise, they would be, I think, would be very shocking, very stark.
There's one thing that Roger, we came together about C-SPAN for science. I don't know how many God channels there are. I mean, how is it that these guys can put on a God channel, 10 of them, or how many? There are golf channels, as you name. And there isn't, we haven't got one channel yet. This is the culture that created this, and in fact, underpins everything. Underpin the bombs and the aeroplanes that they're using to destroy us. And it just seems incredible that we can't just have something that we're very cheap, just going around a conference here on public understanding of science. This sort of conference should have been out today, straight as it was, and it probably will be out there. And yet, it doesn't seem to me very much, and we should go to all the people from Gates and et cetera, to say, look, all you need to do is just give us a channel, give us the money for it. I haven't got it. I mean, maybe the Templeton Foundation has it, and we can get it out there. And I don't think that's very, very much to ask, and it's not very much to achieve. I mean, in my little way, just one guy, I've made 110 television programs. 55 have been shown on the BBC. Okay, we get half a million viewers for our careers programs. There are people out there who want to know what we do, and I think we can do it very easily. We just need the will and the sort of power of people like you and others and other eloquent speakers out here today. Let's go for it. I mean, I've got 10 quid somewhere to start.
We shall be putting that speech to good use, Harry. Don't worry about it. Terry, you want to say something?
Well, I'm heartened by the efforts that you're putting into it and all of your good work, but you know, it's a drop in the bucket. Compared to, like you say, the enormous industry that's out there, entertainment industry, that gives us a few sound bites now and again. And I'm sure all of us here have had the experience of, you know, being interviewed for an hour and then they're waiting for those two words to come out, or, you know, a sentence or two. And then, of course, it gives a completely wrong impression to the public. In other words, we're being forced through a bottleneck that is so small in terms of the bits of information that there is no hope that we'll ever be able to get across anything, let alone anything as complex as the things that we're discovering in science.
But not only that, but you know what we're talking about here is a scientific version of C-SPAN, which is a wonderful thing. But C-SPAN is watched by people who are curious about current affairs. And I think what's needed is something much more of lavish than that. I think we need to have the visual, and we need great music, we need production values, we need to be able to compete for attention with some of the other things that are on television, because what they're doing is they're just pushing the same buttons over and over again. The idea of jeopardy, the idea of violence, the idea of sex, they just use those same buttons and they get a huge audience. What we're trying to do requires a little bit more on the part of the viewer. And so we have to give them more. And that means that we have to be able to visualize the amazing findings of science in such a way so that people are attracted to them.
I think the ideas are paramount, though. You could have the NASA channel there, which shows you wonderful images all day long, but it eventually just becomes wallpaper for people. So I think it's what's important, what we've been trying to do, at least in these initial things, and certainly with a conference like this, is to deal with issues at the intersection of science and social policy, where they affect people's lives, affect their children, affect their health, affect their well-being.
and make it a gold standard source of information for them about those kind of issues. As Carl said, you know, it's suicidal to have a society dependent on science and technology in which hardly anybody knows anything about science and technology.
May I just say one brief thing? I want to mention Carl's new book, which is the Gifford Lectures of 1985 that he gave, called Varieties of Scientific Experience. And I had the honor of editing this book and writing the introduction. And I just want to, you know, maybe this is a good way to end this discussion. In looking through the archives, Carl's archives are voluminous, thousands of files, file drawers, literally thousands, not hyperbolically, but literally. The first 40 years of the space age, but also because his mother knew what a great person he was, even as a child. She saved absolutely every one of his notebooks, and it's very clear that Carl Sagan was who he was when he was even just a very small boy. But looking for the files to find the Gifford lectures, I came upon Carl's transcription, and just to maybe tie this whole thing together, of Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz's very famous quote from Principles of Nature and Grace. And of course, I know you all know that Leibniz was the mathematical and philosophical genius who invented differential and integral calculus independently of Newton. And Leibniz argued that God should be the wall that stopped all further questioning, as he famously wrote in this passage from Principles of Nature and Grace. Why does something exist rather than nothing? For nothing is simpler than something. Now, this sufficient reason for the existence of the universe, which has no need of any other reason, must be a necessary being, else we should not have a sufficient reason with which we could stop. And just beneath this typed quote, Carl wrote, "To Leibniz and to us, so don't stop."
Thank you.